A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He used to work as a pool lifeguard, and his big takeaway wasn't the training or the rescues. It was that when you actually need your first aid kit, your brain is already in panic mode. You've either organized the thing properly, or you're standing there fumbling through gauze pads looking like you've never seen a bandage before. His question is, what's the right organization system for our own first aid kit? How do you divide the cabinet? How do you stock it? And what are the absolute non-negotiables that always need to be there?
This is one of those questions where the answer sounds boring until you need it, and then it's the most important thing in your house. I've thought about this a lot, both from the pediatrician side and just from being the person in the family who gets handed the bloody paper towel situation.
The Family Triage Donkey.
That's the title of my memoir. But here's the thing. Daniel's lifeguard experience gets exactly right. Cognitive load during a first aid event is sky high. Your prefrontal cortex basically clocks out. You're running on habit and spatial memory. If the gauze isn't where your hand expects it to be, you might as well not have it.
The organization is the first aid.
The organization isn't a nice to have on top of the supplies. It is the intervention, and most home kits fail at this spectacularly.
Describe the failure mode. What do most people's kits actually look like?
A plastic tub or a drawer where everything's been dumped in together. Band-aids mixed with tweezers mixed with expired antibiotic ointment mixed with a random ACE bandage from 2019. The lid doesn't close properly. Nobody's checked it in 18 months. When the kid comes in bleeding, you're digging through an archaeology site of medical supplies.
The first aid mitten.
That's when people do the thing you're not supposed to do. They grab whatever's on top and use it, even if it's the wrong thing. A 4x4 gauze pad for a tiny finger cut. An adult-sized bandage wrapped 3 times around a toddler's thumb. It works, but it's sloppy, and sloppy leads to infection or poor wound closure.
Let's build this from the ground up. You've got a cabinet or a drawer. How do you even start thinking about zones?
I'd divide into 4 sections, and I'd make the sections physically distinct. Separate bins, separate shelves, separate labeled containers. The goal is that you can reach in without looking and know what you're touching. The 4 zones are wound care, medications, tools, and instruments, and then a 4th category I'd call situational, splints, wraps, burn care, eye wash.
Why those 4?
Because they map to the order of operations in an actual incident. Step 1 is stop the bleeding and clean the wound. That's wound care. Step 2 is treat pain or prevent infection. That's medications. The tools are what you use throughout. And the situational stuff is for the less common but higher stakes scenarios where you need specific supplies fast.
The spatial layout mirrors the clinical workflow.
And I'd put wound care in the most accessible position, top shelf or front of drawer, because bleeding is the thing that can't wait. If someone's bleeding enough to need a kit, you don't want to be moving bins out of the way to find gauze.
What's in wound care specifically? And I want to hear about gauze pads, because I feel like there's a whole taxonomy here that people don't know.
There is, and it matters. The core wound care supplies sterile gauze pads in 2 sizes, 2x2 and 4x4. The 2x2s are for small cuts, the 4x4s are for larger wounds or for applying pressure. You want at least 10 of each. Then you need rolled gauze. This is for wrapping and securing pads in place, especially on limbs. Adhesive bandages in multiple sizes, including the little fingertip and knuckle ones that most kits skip. Medical tape, cloth tape, not the paper stuff that falls off if someone so much as looks at it. Antiseptic wipes or spray. I prefer the wipes because they're single use and you know they're sterile. And then the thing everyone forgets, sterile saline solution for irrigation. Cleaning a wound properly. Running it under the tap is fine for minor stuff, but if you've got a deeper cut or a burn, you want sterile saline to flush it out. A wound that isn't properly cleaned is a wound that gets infected. The Mayo Clinic guidelines are very clear on this. Irrigation is step 1 for any significant wound before you even think about antiseptic.
Wound care zone is gauze pads in 2 sizes, rolled gauze, adhesive bandages in multiple sizes, cloth tape, antiseptic wipes, sterile saline.
I'd add one more, hemostatic gauze. This is gauze impregnated with a clotting agent. It's what they use in combat medicine and in Stop the Bleed kits. For a home kit, it's for the scenario where direct pressure isn't stopping the bleeding. A deep laceration, a kitchen knife accident. It's not expensive, and it could save someone's life.
Kitchen knife accidents are probably the most likely serious bleeding scenario in a home.
And people don't realize how fast a deep cut can become dangerous. A femoral artery bleed, you've got minutes. Even a bad hand laceration can produce a shocking amount of blood. Having hemostatic gauze and knowing it's right there in the wound care bin changes the whole response.
Zone 2, medications.
I'd split this into two subcategories, topical and oral. Topical, antibiotic ointment, hydrocortisone cream for rashes and bug bites, burn gel, and something people don't think about, calamine lotion or a similar anti-itch treatment. Oral, acetaminophen, ibuprofen, diphenhydramine for allergic reactions, and aspirin. Aspirin is specifically there for the heart attack scenario. If someone's showing heart attack symptoms, chewing an aspirin while waiting for emergency services can reduce clot formation.
That's one of those things where it's not a daily use item, but when you need it immediately.
You need to know exactly where it is. That's the organizing principle for the whole medication zone. Separate it clearly from wound care, because in a non-bleeding emergency like an allergic reaction or a suspected heart attack, you don't want to be sorting through bandages to find the right pill.
How do you organize within the medication zone? Just a bin with bottles?
I'd use small labeled containers or a divided organizer. Oral medications in one section, topicals in another. And this is the zone where expiration dates matter most. Medications degrade, especially in bathroom cabinets where there's humidity. Check the dates every 6 months. Write the expiration date in Sharpie on the top of the bottle so you can see it at a glance.
The Sharpie on the cap trick. Simple and effective.
The whole kit should be checked every 6 months, but medications are the most time-sensitive part. Expired ibuprofen probably won't hurt you, but it loses potency. Expired antibiotic ointment can actually become contaminated. Not worth the risk.
Zone 3. Tools.
Tweezers. Good ones, not the flimsy things that come in a grooming kit. You want fine point tweezers for splinters and ticks. Blunt tip scissors for cutting bandages and tape, the kind that won't stab the patient if you're working fast. A digital thermometer with spare probe covers. Disposable gloves, nitrile, not latex, because latex allergies are common and you don't want to discover one during an emergency. A CPR face shield or pocket mask. And this is the one where I get on my soapbox, a tourniquet.
A tourniquet in a home kit. That's going to raise some eyebrows.
It shouldn't. The evidence on tourniquets has completely shifted in the last 20 years. The old advice was that tourniquets were a last resort because they'd automatically cost the limb. We now know that's wrong. A properly applied tourniquet can stay on for hours without permanent damage, and in a severe arterial bleed, it's the only thing that works. Every home kit should have one, and everyone in the house should know where it is and how to use it.
Is this the Stop the Bleed curriculum talking?
And I stand by it. A tourniquet is $30. It takes 10 minutes to learn. The scenarios where you'd need it are rare, but they're the scenarios where nothing else will do. Kitchen accident, power tool accident, a kid falling through a glass door. These things happen.
The $30 insurance policy.
And store it with the tools, not buried somewhere. This goes back to Daniel's point about organization. In a severe bleed, your fine motor skills degrade. You need to be able to grab the tourniquet without thinking.
Zone 4, the situational stuff.
This is the catch-all for things that aren't used in every incident but are critical when they're needed. Instant cold packs for sprains and swelling. An elastic bandage, the ACE wrap kind, for compression. A SAM splint or similar moldable splint for fractures. Eyewash solution or an eye cup. Burn dressings. These are different from regular gauze. They're designed not to stick to burned skin. And I'd put a space blanket in here too, the reflective mylar kind, for shock management.
That's a thing people don't think about for a home kit.
After a serious injury, keeping the person warm and lying down with their feet elevated is basic but essential. A space blanket weighs nothing and takes up no space. There's no reason not to have one.
We've got 4 zones, each in its own container. Where does the kid actually live?
Not the bathroom. That's my first rule. Bathrooms are humid, and humidity degrades supplies. Adhesive bandages lose their stick. Gauze can get mildewy. Medications break down faster. The kit should be in a dry, climate-controlled space. A hallway closet, a kitchen cabinet away from the stove, a dedicated shelf in the laundry room.
Somewhere central and accessible.
Known to everyone in the house. This is the other half of organization that nobody talks about, the social organization. Every adult and every kid old enough to understand should know where the kit is and what's in it. You don't need a toddler to know how to use a tourniquet, but a 10-year-old should know where the band-aids are and how to clean a small cut.
The best organized kid in the world is useless if you're the only one who knows it exists.
If you're the one who's injured, you need someone else to access it. I'd even go further. Do a walkthrough with the family once a year. Open the kit, show everyone the zones, let them handle the supplies. Familiarity reduces panic. It's the same principle as fire drills.
The organization system has a training component built in.
And this connects to something the emergency medicine literature emphasizes, the concept of just in time versus just in case. Most first aid supplies are just in case. You hope you never need them. But the organization and the training are what bridge the gap between having the supplies and actually using them effectively when the moment comes.
Let's talk about the cabinet itself. You mentioned separate containers for each zone. What does that actually look like in practice?
I'd use clear plastic bins with labels. Not opaque. You want to see what's inside. Each bin gets a label on the front and on the top. Wound care, medications, tools, situational. Inside each bin, smaller dividers or Ziploc bags for subcategories. The key is that nothing is loose. If you open the wound care bin and gauze pads are just floating around, you've already lost.
The loose item is the enemy of the organized kit.
It really is. And this is where most commercial first aid kits fail. They come in a nice zippered case with elastic loops and little pockets, and it looks organized. But the moment you use one thing, the whole system falls apart. You can't restock it neatly because the elastic is stretched or the pocket is the wrong size. A bin system is modular and restockable.
You're advocating for building your own kit rather than buying a pre-made one.
Pre-made kits are fine as a starting point, but they're almost never organized the way you need, and they're full of filler. Tiny band-aids, single-use packets of things you'll never use, cheap scissors that can't cut anything. You're better off buying the components separately and building a system that matches your household.
What about size? How big a cabinet are we talking?
Bigger than a shoebox, smaller than a filing cabinet. A medium plastic storage bin, maybe 18 inches by 12 inches by 10 inches, can hold everything we've described with room to spare. If you're using a cabinet shelf, two or three of those clear shoebox-sized bins side by side works perfectly. The point is that everything is visible and reachable without moving things around.
If you're in an apartment with limited space,
then you prioritize. Wound care and medications in one bin, tools and situational in another. Two bins instead of four. The zone concept still applies, you're just combining categories. The non-negotiable is that wound care is always the most accessible.
Let's go back to the stocking list. You mentioned expiration dates on medications. What about the other supplies? Do gauze pads expire?
Sterile gauze pads do have an expiration date, but it's about sterility, not degradation. If the package is intact and dry, it's probably fine past the date, but for something that's going on an open wound, I wouldn't push it more than a year. The bigger issue is storage conditions. If the package has been crushed or exposed to moisture, toss it. Adhesive bandages lose their stick over time regardless of the date. If the wrapper looks crinkled or the bandage feels stiff, replace it. Tourniquets have a shelf life, but it's generous. Typically 5 to 10 years if stored properly. The windlass mechanism can degrade, and the strap material can become brittle. Check it during your 6-month review. Give it a visual inspection. Make sure the windlass turns smoothly.
6-month review. That's the recurring maintenance.
Put it on the calendar. Same weekend you check your smoke detector batteries. It takes 15 minutes. Open every bin, check for anything that's been used and needs replacing, check expiration dates, make sure nothing's been pilfered for a school project.
The kid needed gauze for a diorama.
You laugh, but it happens. First aid kits get raided for non-medical purposes all the time. Tape goes missing. The 6-month check catches that before the emergency does.
What's the most commonly missing item in home kits, in your experience?
People don't think about wound irrigation, so they never buy it, or they buy it once and it expires. The second most missing is gloves. People are treating their own family members and think they don't need them. But blood is blood, and you don't know what's in it.
That's a sobering point. Even with family.
Especially with family. If you're treating someone else's wound and you have a small cut on your own hand that you forgot about, you've just created a potential transmission pathway. Gloves are cheap and disposable. There's no reason to skip them.
Let's talk about the pediatric angle, since that was part of the prompt, parents of young children.
For households with kids, I'd add a few things to each zone. In wound care, more adhesive bandages in kid-friendly sizes. The little fingertip and knuckle ones are essential because kids injure those areas constantly. Also, Steri-Strips or butterfly closures for small cuts that need more than a band-aid but don't need stitches. In medications, children's formulations of acetaminophen and ibuprofen with a dosing chart taped to the inside of the bin lid, do not rely on your memory for pediatric dosing. Weight-based dosing is precise, and an overdose of acetaminophen can cause liver failure.
The dosing chart on the lid is a great detail.
It's one of those things that takes 2 minutes to make and could prevent a serious error. Write the child's current weight, the correct dose, and the date you updated it. Update it every 6 months along with the rest of the kit review.
What about for infants specifically?
A rectal thermometer. They're more accurate for infants. And when you have a newborn with a fever, accuracy matters because fever in a baby under 3 months is a medical emergency. Also, a nasal aspirator, the bulb syringe kind, for clearing airways. And this is going to sound odd, but a bottle of Pedialyte or oral rehydration solution. Dehydration from vomiting or diarrhea is one of the most common reasons young children end up in the ER, and having oral rehydration on hand can stabilize them while you're figuring out whether you need to go in.
The pediatric additions are really about the most common failure modes for little kids: fever, dehydration, and small but messy injuries.
And the dosing chart. I can't emphasize that enough. The number of parents I saw in the ER who had given their child the wrong dose of something because they guessed is not small.
What about the psychological side of this? The prompt mentioned that in an emergency, your brain can't really think. Are there tricks beyond just good organization?
One is the first three things. Rule. When you open the kit, the first three things you should see are the three things you're most likely to need in the most common emergencies: gloves, gauze pads, and antiseptic wipes. If those are the first things your hand touches, you're already on the right track for most incidents.
Prime real estate in the kit.
The beachfront property of your first aid bin. Another trick is color coding. Wound care supplies go in a red bin, medications in a white bin, tools in a blue bin, situational in a yellow bin. Under stress, color recognition is faster than reading labels. You don't even need to buy colored bins. Colored tape on the edges works fine.
Color coding is smart. It's the same principle as fire extinguisher signs. Red means this is where you go for bleeding.
It works across language barriers and reading levels. A kid who can't read yet can learn red bin means band-aids.
How does this system hold up in the scenario where it's not you accessing the kit? A babysitter? A visiting relative?
That's where labeling becomes critical. Every bin should have a label on the front that says what's in it. And inside the lid of the main cabinet or container, I'd tape a simple inventory list. Wound care, gauze pads, bandages, tape, antiseptic wipes, saline, medications, pain relief, allergy, topical creams, check expiration dates, tools, scissors, tweezers, thermometer, gloves, tourniquet, situational, ice packs, splint, burn dressings, eye wash.
A stranger can walk up and orient themselves in 10 seconds.
That's the standard. If someone who's never seen your kit before can't find what they need in under 30 seconds, the organization has failed.
That's a good benchmark. The 30-second rule.
Have a friend who doesn't live in your house walk up to your kit and say, "I just cut my hand. What do I do?" Watch where they look. Watch where they fumble. That'll tell you more about your organization than any checklist.
Let's talk about what shouldn't be in the kit. What are people storing in their first aid supplies that doesn't belong there?
Old prescription medications. Leftover antibiotics from a previous illness, painkillers from a surgery 5 years ago. These should not be in your first aid kit. They're not for acute first aid, they're often expired, and taking partial courses of antibiotics is how you breed antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Dispose of them properly.
The pharmacy take-bag program, not the trash.
Second thing that shouldn't be there, hydrogen peroxide. I know, everyone's grandmother used it, but current wound care guidelines advise against it. It damages healthy tissue and can actually slow healing. Soap and water or sterile saline for cleaning, antiseptic wipes for disinfection. Skip the peroxide.
Grandma's going to be upset about that one.
Grandma meant well, but wound care has advanced. Third thing, cotton balls. They leave fibers in the wound. Use sterile gauze pads instead. Fourth, anything that's been opened and not resealed properly. A tube of antibiotic ointment with the cap missing. A bottle of saline that's been open for 6 months. Those are contamination risks, not medical supplies.
The half-used capless tube of ointment is the universal sign of a neglected first aid kit.
It's practically a diagnostic criterion.
What about the cabinet location relative to hazards? You mentioned not the bathroom. Any other placement rules?
Not in the garage if you live somewhere with temperature extremes. Summer heat can degrade medications and adhesives. Not above the stove, grease and steam are not your supplies' friends. And not in a locked cabinet unless you have a specific safety concern like a family member with dementia or a child with behavioral issues. In most households, the kit should be unlocked and unobstructed. Speed of access matters more than security.
The locked cabinet adds a step between you and the supplies when seconds count.
If you're not the one with the key, or you can't find the key, or your hands are shaking too much to work the lock, you've just defeated the purpose of having the kit.
What about multiple kits? One central kit versus smaller kits in different locations.
I'm a fan of the central kit plus a small car kit. The central kit has everything we've described. The car kit is more basic: wound care essentials, gloves, a tourniquet, an emergency blanket, and a flashlight. Car accidents are the most likely serious injury scenario outside the home, and having supplies in the trunk that you check when you rotate your tires is just good practice.
For a two-story house,
central kit on the main floor, and a small ouch pouch upstairs. Band-aids, antiseptic wipes, a few gauze pads. Enough to handle a minor incident without running downstairs, but not a duplicate of the full kit. The full kit is the single source of truth.
The ouch pouch. I like that. What about documentation? Should there be a first aid manual in the kit?
Yes, but not a thick one. A concise first aid reference card, the kind you can get from the Red Cross or download and laminate. Step-by-step instructions for bleeding control, CPR, choking, burns, allergic reactions. In an emergency, you're not going to read a chapter. You need bullet points and diagrams.
The laminated card you can hold in one hand, while the other hand applies pressure.
And I'd put it in a sleeve on the inside of the cabinet door or taped to the lid of the main bin, not buried inside. It's a reference, not a supply.
Let's circle back to the psychological part. The prompt really emphasized that moment of panic. You're either organized or you're fumbling. Is there something about the physical act of opening a well-organized kit that actually helps regulate that panic?
That's a really interesting question. I think there is. When you open a kit and everything is where it's supposed to be, your hand finds the gauze without searching, the gloves are right there. That smoothness creates a sense of competence. You feel like you know what you're doing, even if you're scared. And that confidence feeds back into your performance. You're calmer, you move more deliberately, you make better decisions.
The kit as a psychological anchor.
Whereas the chaotic kit amplifies the panic. You're already scared, and now you can't find what you need, and every second of fumbling makes you feel more out of control. It's a vicious cycle.
The organization isn't just about efficiency. It's about emotional regulation in a crisis.
And this is something the emergency medicine people understand intuitively. Operating rooms are organized the same way every time, not just for efficiency, but because predictability reduces cognitive load and allows the team to focus on the patient instead of the environment.
The home first aid kit is a miniature operating room. Same principles, scaled down.
Same principles, exactly. Sterile field, organized zones, everything in its place, everyone knows their role.
What's the one thing you'd tell someone to do this weekend if they're listening and realizing their kit is a disaster?
Dump everything out. All of it. Spread it on the kitchen table. Check every expiration date. Throw out anything expired, anything opened, anything you don't recognize. Then sort what's left into the four zones. If you're missing essentials, and you probably are, make a list and go to the pharmacy. Don't buy a pre-made kit. Buy the specific items you need.
The clean slate approach.
It's the only way. You can't organize a mess by rearranging the mess. You have to start from zero. any container store, hardware store, or even the home organization section of a big box store. Clear plastic shoeboxes with lids. A label maker if you're feeling fancy, masking tape, and a Sharpie if you're not. Total investment is maybe $40 in containers plus whatever supplies you need to restock.
That's remarkably accessible.
It should be. This isn't a luxury good, it's basic household infrastructure.
What about people who live in small spaces? Studio apartments, dorm rooms, the four-bin system might be overkill.
Then you go vertical. A single divided container, think a tackle box or a craft organizer with adjustable compartments. Wound care in the biggest compartment, medications in the next, tools and situational in the smaller ones. Same zones, same labels, same principle, just compressed into a smaller footprint.
The tackle box first aid kit. That's actually a great image.
The compartments keep things separated, the handle makes it portable, and you can slide it under a bed or onto a closet shelf. Just make sure it's not buried behind other things.
Let's address something we haven't touched. What about when you use something up? The restocking discipline.
This is where most systems fail. You use the last 4x4 gauze pad, you tell yourself you'll buy more, and 6 months later, there's still an empty slot. The fix is simple. Keep a small notepad in the kit, and the moment you use something, write it down. When you do your 6-month review, that list is your shopping list. Alternatively, keep a backup supply. Buy gauze in bulk and store the extras in a separate location, then restock the kit from the backup.
The backup supply is the lazy person's restocking system.
I say that with no judgment. The best system is the one you'll actually maintain. If having a box of backup supplies in the linen closet means your kit stays stocked, do that.
What's the most overlooked item in the whole setup?
The pen and notepad. If you're dealing with an injury and you need to call emergency services, you want to write down what you did and when. What time did you apply the tourniquet? What medication did you give? And at what dose? Paramedics will ask these questions, and in the stress of the moment, you'll forget. A notepad and pen in the kit means you can jot it down in real time.
That's the kind of detail that only comes from experience.
It really is. Nobody thinks about documentation during a first aid incident until they've been asked, when did you give the epinephrine, and realize they have no idea.
The final kit inventory. Let's put it all in one place. Wound care, 2x2 and 4x4 sterile gauze pads, rolled gauze adhesive bandages in multiple sizes, cloth medical tape, antiseptic wipes, sterile saline, hemostatic gauze. Medications, acetaminophen, ibuprofen, diphenhydramine, aspirin, antibiotic ointment, hydrocortisone cream, burn gel, calamine lotion. Tools. Fine point tweezers, blunt tip scissors, digital thermometer, nitrile gloves, CPR face shield, tourniquet, situational, instant cold packs, elastic bandage, SAM splint, eye wash, burn dressings, space blanket, plus first aid reference card, pen and notepad, dosing chart for kids.
That's the list. It sounds like a lot when you say it all at once, but it fits in a surprisingly small space when it's organized.
The total cost, roughly?
If you're starting from scratch, maybe $100 to $150 for everything, plus the bins. The tourniquet and the SAM splint are the priciest individual items. But this is a one-time purchase with occasional restocking. Spread over the years you'll have it, it's nothing.
Compared to an ER visit, it's rounding error.
It might prevent that ER visit, or at least improve the outcome before you get there. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
A standard Eaton 5's cord is roughly 11.5 cubits long, which means you could fit about 234 million Eaton 5's cords end-to-end across the length of Lake Tanganyika, assuming you didn't mind them getting very wet.
I have so many questions, and I'm choosing to ask none of them. Here's the forward-looking thought I want to leave with. We've spent this whole episode talking about organizing a box of medical supplies, but the deeper question is about how we prepare for the moments when we're not our best selves. The kit is a prosthetic for a brain that's flooded with adrenaline. And I think there's a broader principle there about designing our environments for our worst moments, not our best ones.
We organize for the version of ourselves that's scared and shaking and not thinking clearly. That person deserves a well-stocked kit as much as the calm, competent version of ourselves does.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping us running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.